Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and this is how I talk. Now. But as a kid, oh man, I was a disaster. Or, as we said growing up in Queens, a disaster. We were apparently very confused by the letter R. If it was at the end of a word, you pronounced it like a UH. Come here was Camilla. And if a word didn't have the good sense to end in the letter R, it was up to you to supply it. So you might be studying about countries like China and Cuba in school. This all started to change when I got into a high school in Manhattan, which had kids from all over the place. Because of the kind of school it was, I knew we were in the same general ballpark academically, but I was immediately struck by how smart some kids sounded and how, you know, not as smart others sounded. This was followed by the dawning horror, or the dawning horror, of the realization that I was in the latter category. I've been thinking about this because I just saw Lake Bell's new film, In a World. It's hilarious, but it also makes the point that the way we speak is a powerful part of how we present ourselves, and Lake Bell will join us momentarily to talk about that. We'll also look ahead to some of the most keenly anticipated albums of the fall season, always a good time for music fans. But as summer gives way to fall, the last of the summer music festivals here in New York was marred by a couple of deaths attributed to the drug MDMA. We'll find out why this designer drug has become so closely linked to the rise of electronic dance music. All of that coming up today on Soundcheck. But first,
in a world of glamour and greed, a world of money and mystery, one man must find a way to describe to all of humanity this world. One man will leave his mark on this world by uttering these three powerful words, in a world. And that one man is
a woman.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the voice of Lake Bell, the writer, director, and star of the movie In a World. Lake, I don't normally ask my guests to get involved in their own introduction, but it just somehow seemed appropriate for you.
Thank you. yes, at any point, if you give me, you know, headphones and a microphone, I'm gonna pretty much get excited and want to participate.
Now, how long have you been sort of interested in the kind of inherent musicality of our voices, the difference in our voices, the kind of impact of our voices?
I guess I was always vocally self-aware, and I started to obsess about the people around me and the sort of hilarity in characterizations that were formed just based on how someone sounds, whether they're really nasal or whether, you know, they're kind of guttural or, you know, whatever it is. I mean, sure, it starts with cartoons a little bit, which, you know, you start to kind of mimic and you listen to these voices. And I remember the first time, someone told me that, you know, a certain character was played by a woman, even though the character was male.
Like Bart Simpson.
Like, for instance, Bart Simpson. But that kind of blew my mind. I think the idea that, oh, my goodness, you can be anyone, you know, it's the blind voice. You aren't judged by what you look like, but you really can be anything. You could be any social niveau or any, you know, any nationality, but any gender for that matter.
In what you just said, in the last 60 seconds, you used three different voices in three different registers. I mean, which is the natural Lake Bell voice?
I try my hardest every day to speak as I was born, and this is my natural voice. But I think, you know, in the same way that I lived in England, I went to drama school there, and, you know, everyone said, oh, my God, did you get the accent? And I was like, no, not at all. I mean, God, I'm so self-aware. If anything, I became more American because I was the token American at my college. So I think if you – and I was constantly studying voice. So if you're listening to your voice, there's no way that a little like, oh, yeah, absolutely, would get in there. I mean, there's no way that I would oops, all of a sudden say brilliant, you know, or boot.
So the idea of doing a movie about the voiceover industry, this incredible, not just male-dominated, but dominated by like literally a handful of male voices.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are female voices that are working and extremely successful, but there's just, I think when it comes to the movie trailer industry, that's where I found a massive dearth of female voices.
Right.
And that is without hyperbole. There's virtually none. I mean, Melissa Disney being the only woman to have done it. And there was actually one woman actually came, tweeted me and said, you know, I just wanted to let you know that I did a TV spot for, you know, a film that came out. So the point is, it's very few.
Right.
And I thought, ooh, that's an opportunity to sort of playfully talk about more real issue that is perhaps feminist.
Yeah. But without, you know, without being up on your, you know, on your pedestal, on your soapbox or anything like that. It's a very funny movie called In a World, written and directed by Lake Bell, who stars as Carol Solomon, who is the daughter of one of these handful of vocal artists.
Yes. Fred Melamed masterfully plays Sam Soto, who is the reigning sort of king of the voiceover industry. And he is loosely based on, I mean, he's not really based on Don LaFontaine, but he basically has fame because of Don LaFontaine.
And Don LaFontaine is actually mentioned in your film one of numerous times where the line between fact and fiction gets a little blurry.
Yes. I think in order for Sam Soto, Fred Melamed, his character to have that chip on his shoulder, like he's not the guy, you know, like
he's not Don LaFontaine.
He's not Don LaFontaine. Right. The master and the legend was Don LaFontaine,
who died in 2008.
Yes, 5 years ago. Yeah,
and he's the guy. They say he coined the phrase "in a world."
Yes, ooh, it's fun to say, isn't it?
did he actually write? Doesn't someone else write the script?
Well, he was a copywriter. The story goes that he sort of wrote copy for trailers and whatnot. And some guy didn't show up for the session. So they, you know, they're like, Don, why don't you get in there and record a temp track? And lo and behold, you know, all trailers were changed forever.
The website Funny or Die did a mashup of Don LaFontaine trailers just to give you an idea of the voice that we're talking about.
In a world, in the year 2017,
in a time of tradition,
in a city where anything can happen,
in a war that isn't his,
every day in New York City,
on the Miami police force,
in the deep south,
from the sewers of Gotham,
from the rooftops of Gotham,
above Gotham,
within this skyscraper high above the city,
in a town driven by competition,
in a world that's powered by violence.
It's so fun.
That is the real Don LaFontaine. And Lake Bell, you are absolutely right. It is so much fun to drop down a register and go, in a world.
Yeah, it's this thing that I just found. I remember, you know, just with friends, even just sort of voice-overing very banal things like, in a world where one woman needs to use the Ladvertor, you know, it's like whatever it was. And sort of considering why a female voice has never been able to do that. So that's really where the conversation started. And
right.
It's sort of silly and fun. You know, it's the whole job, the occupation is playful.
And the movie, In a World, sort of turns on this idea that they're going to bring back, they can't bring back Don LaFontaine,
no,
but they can bring back his catchphrase.
Exactly.
And
with great respect, they want to resurrect those three little words.
Right. And your character, Carol, as someone who's doing vocal coaching and is the daughter of this famous vocal actor,
mm-hmm,
finds herself in a position of maybe kind of getting that job.
Yeah, I mean, she inadvertently sort of becomes a voice in the community and very quickly sort of becomes kind of a hip choice, which threatens the hubris of her father, who is the reigning king.
And he decides that he's now going to get back in the game and compete. And in this scene from the movie, In a World, Lake Bell and Fred Melamed and
Ken Marino, who plays sort of my nemesis, but also that my character might or might not sleep with. And so this becomes sort of a montage of vocal competition.
In a world
where a hybrid breed of mutant male savages
are feeding on the barren lands of Mother Earth.
A time where mankind has been replaced by womankind.
A battle of epic strength will collapse a barbaric enemy.
One woman
dare to rise up and exceed the boundaries of the impossible. From the literary phenomenon that inspired a generation comes a quadrilogy
of one brave warrior who must fight for her land.
From BAFTA-winning director Terrence Pouncer, the Amazon Games.
It's a broad new world.
That is so cheesy. It's perfect.
Thanks.
It's perfect. Lake Bell is with me on Soundcheck. She's the writer, director, and star of the new movie In a World, and has also acted in It's Complicated and What Happens in Vegas and No Strings Attached, etc. Fred Melamed, I mean, it was pretty clear to me just from listening to him that this guy was in the business in real life.
Oh, he's big time.
Ken Marino has the cheese factor down pat.
He is, you know, he has an access to cheesiness in his repertoire.
And what were you going for there? Were you playing for laughs, or were you really trying to make point that, hey, I can do this?
No, I mean, I'm not a fan of ever playing for laughs, really. I like, you know, I shot this movie like a drama, you know, and every scene was attacked and respected as, you know, real circumstances and grounded in reality. And, you know, that's sort of a fantasy for a comedian anyway, a comedic actor, you know, to really take it seriously. So both Ken Marino, I mean, look, Ken Marino, me and Fred all took that really seriously.
Yeah.
And I thought that's the only way that it's going to be hilarious.
Yes. Yeah.
And really silly. So, you know, I mean, we all tried our hardest. And, you know, of course, Fred Melamed being actually a master voiceover artist, you know, his sounds pretty professional.
Yeah.
But also Ken Marino's character kind of represents the new school, kind of the sort of rising trend in the voiceover community and announcing for this sort of everyday man. You know, meet Jack. He's one guy who just, you know, that kind of more, you know.
Is that the new trend in announcing?
Well,
is that what I'm supposed to be?
No.
Is that what I'm supposed to be doing here?
God, no. No, but you know what I'm saying? Like in voiceover, that kind of, that sort of like snarky, you know, sarcastic. I'm just a guy like you. I got a garage and a motorcycle, you know.
Well, as you say, Melissa Disney is a voiceover actor who's gotten some work and has
a bit
part in your movie.
Yes, she does. Her scene is not in the movie, but it will be on the DVD. She did a great scene. And yes, she did Gone in 60 Seconds. She's sort of like famous in the community for doing the only.
And you know, she has a kind of a sultry voice without being the sexy baby voice that
Correct.
Your character is fingernails on a blackboard to her when she hears that. And she hears it throughout the movie increasing comic effect as the movie goes along.
Oh, good. Okay, good. Because it's with, I mean, look, it's with great respect and playfulness that I poke fun at that particular affectation. But yes, I think, you know, sultry is different than, you know, sexy baby, which I think is diminutive.
Where does that voice? I mean, this.
Which one, the sexy baby?
The sexy baby voice is everywhere now.
I think it originated somewhere west. And, you know, it started even just with the culture of Valley Girl.
Right, the Valley Girl speak,
yeah. But that was kind of a whole way to dress and way to be and what kind of car to drive. I mean, that was in everything, all-encompassing culture. But the voice actually now has morphed into a myriad of different things, sort of a cocktail of these different affectations. So it's pitch, but it's also up-talking and then fry. So it's like this mix of, you know, it's not even like saying the word like, but it's insinuating it. So it's insinuating this sort of, I don't know, like you're less than, you know, than the rest of the people in the world, which I think is really unfair because a lot of well-educated, smart, cool ladies and gals are speaking that way. And so in the movie, I'm sort of saying, hey, you can do better than that.
Right. And it's not doing them any favors, as in this scene from Lake Bell's movie, In a World.
I guess let's start with Stacy. Stacy, what do you do for a living?
I'm a corporate attorney. Great. And I know you've been on a job hunt. How's that going for you?
Well, I've been interviewing for about 10 months.
And why do you think that is?
Because I sound like a sexy baby.
Which may be great for the bedroom.
Yeah, it is.
But am I really going to hire a sexy baby to defend me in a patent infringement lawsuit?
That's a good point.
Look, it's a good point. Listen, do whatever you want in closed doors. Frankly, do whatever you want as you walk around the world. But I feel that if you, you know, do talk that way and you're trying to achieve the goals in your life, that perhaps you're doing yourself a great disservice by putting yourself in a section that is not the contenders. You know, if you walk through the door, even if it's like across, you know, sitting across the table of a really cool guy, or it's walking into that room to do that interview for that job, you know, and you have that voice, I mean, sometimes, I mean, more often than not, you're not going to get hired, because I wouldn't want my company being represented. I mean, I couldn't have anyone on my set who spoke that way. I had a girl come in, and a very sweet, sweet girl, smart, great on paper, come in to be my my assistant on the movie, you know, my director's assistant. And she was like, I just want to say, like, I really want to be here. And like, I've worked really. And I was like, oh, my God, you lost me at hello. Like, I can't hire you. I think you're a great kid. You know, but I'm going to have to make this movie, have you see it, and then get the message in a sweet way, and then perhaps we can talk.
Can those things, they're affectations, right? They can be changed?
Absolutely.
Is that the point?
I mean, look, a lot of people, you know, if you grow up with a sibilance or a lisp or...
a heavy Queens accent?
Or a heavy Queen, yeah. No, but some... really?
Yeah. Oh,
all
yeah.
All right. So this
yeah,
is great.
No,
so
I asked my friends to play in the street after school, you know?
But that's what's so interesting is that, you know, and it's not to say the Queen's accent is a bad accent. It's just
it's a bad accent.
Well, I kind of love it. But look, I'm an accent aficionado and lover. So for me, I'm like, oh, put it on. But this isn't an accent. It's sort of, it's like you said, an affectation.
Yeah.
And similarly, you know, there are, you know, communities of people who take on different accents.
It's kind of like, I don't know if you've spent a lot of time in Japan, but apparently women are taught to speak a certain way to men, which is different from how they speak to each other. I mean, traditionally, but it's still taught.
In pitch?
Yeah, it's at a higher pitch.
Oh, interesting. Okay, yeah.
We're speaking with Lake Bell, who's the star and producer and director and writer of the film In a World, which is, it's not just about the voiceover industry, it's about the sound of our speech and the sound of our world, and of course there's music involved. And how, I mean, this is your movie. You must have been pretty involved in that part of it.
I was. Chris DeRuytis was my music supervisor.
Formerly of KCRW.
Indeed, indeed. And my score was done by Ryan Miller of Guster.
Mm-hmm.
And both gentlemen, I am very thankful for A, putting up with my demands and allowing me to collaborate with them. I'm really proud of the score that Ryan did, and especially because I said to him, it was so hard, but I was like, I want like Afro jazz funk meets new age. You know, new wave.
And did you use that voice when you
new
said that?
Wave. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Lots of weird voices. I'd be like, oh, like new wave meets Afro jazz funk, you know. But so he did an amazing job. And then, yeah, we've got, I didn't want any of the music to be too contemporary. Mm-hmm. I feel like the movie, we all get it. It's taking place now. So I tried to take, you know, measures to keep it kind of timeless as I could and city-less as I could. Like, yeah. There's no Capitol Records building, you know, shots. There's very little palm trees. There's no iPhone, because I think the iPhone sort of brings us, it's almost like having a celebrity in your movie. It's like, it takes you out, you know?
Yeah.
So, same with the music. I wanted to have music that, within my budget, music that I grew up with that felt evocative and that brought you somewhere. And I have grew up with older brothers. My brother Luke always exposed me to music. And I guess that's why Jerry Rafferty is in the movie and had to be in the movie. That's why I wrote in Tears for Fears, you know.
What was the song you were most excited to get into the film?
Probably Everybody Wants to Rule the World by Tears for Fears, because I had written that into the movie, which was bold for a tiny movie, because of course, you know, my producers were like, We can talk about that. I'm like, it's in the movie. Well, we can discuss it. It's in the movie. You know, because it just always felt, I don't know, it was sort of naive for me to write it into the movie to know that what if I couldn't have gotten it?
Right.
Know? But I'm very thankful to it. I do use it twice in the movie as well.
It ends the movie,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
The movie is called In a World, and it stars Lake Bell. She wrote and directed it as well. It is out now. It is a lot of fun, in addition to raising, you know, some questions about,
sure, yeah,
you know, how we present ourselves
Let's
with our voices and stuff. Lake, it's been really a lot of fun having you with us on
Thank
Soundcheck
you.
Today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's so fun.
Coming up, we'll turn from a new movie to new music with critic Tris McCall of the New Jersey Star-Ledger. He'll join us to preview the barrage of new albums coming out this fall. And later, a major New York music festival was cut short after two suspected drug-related deaths. We'll hear more about the popularity of MDMA, or Molly, in the world of electronic dance music. That's later on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Okay, folks, got some bad news. Summer is over. I know, that's not what the calendar says, but let's face it. Sandy beaches, outdoor grilling, catchy pop singles that infect the summer, those are all behind us now. But one thing gets better after Labor Day. Albums. That's right, there's a slate of hotly anticipated records coming at us in the weeks ahead, and we've invited Tris McCall, music critic of the New Jersey Star-Ledger, to bring his crystal ball into the Soundcheck studio and tell us about some of them. Hi, Tris.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So some of these hotly anticipated records are actually with us already.
Uh-huh.
And I know you've been really excited about the Nico Case record.
Yeah, I think this is the best album that she's done, and I've really liked everything that she has done.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's a master of making the full-length work. She'll give you three or four songs that are immediately catchy, that get in your head and get you singing and get you coming back to the album. And then there are other songs that are very mysterious and take a couple of listens to unfold. So there's always something fresh when you return to the record.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that this album is paced gives you a very, very nice ride. It starts catchy, goes into the more mysterious territory, and then it finishes strong. It finishes very catchy and exciting.
So this song, Night Still Comes, this is early on in the record. We're still
this
in the catchy mode.
Yes,
here.
And it's got a great tag, a great refrain. It's one of the first things that you remember when you come back to the album. And it's what she does so well. It gives you an intriguing proposition,
mm-hmm,
something that'll catch in your head that you can think about a couple of different ways.
Nico Case, the alt-country singer, also known for her work with the New Pornographers. Her new record is called The Worse Things Get, The Harder I Fight, The Harder I Fight, The More I Love You.
There are so many tools that are made from my hands, but the tide smashes all my best laid plans to sand. And there's always someone to say it's easy for me, but I revenge myself all over myself. There's nothing you can say to me. You never held it at the right angle. You never held it at the right angle. Catch a, catch a, catch a, catch a falling star. Wash your hands of it. Catch a, catch a, catch a, catch a falling star. Because you can't.
Just a little bit from the new Nico Case record. Her new album is called The Worse Things Get, The Harder I Fight, The Harder I Fight, The More I Love You. And the song is Night Still Comes. Tris McCall, music critic for the New Jersey Star-Ledger, calls this the best Nico Case album yet,
yeah,
which is saying something,
yeah,
given her track record.
Fox Confessor was a great album, but I think she realizes her distinctive, you know, combination of mystery and pop catchiness on this album better than on any of her other projects. And it really includes the work that she did with the New Pornographers.
Mm-hmm.
You were saying that the musicianship on the record is terrific.
The drumming in that, yeah, and that song is really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, great playing all over that album.
Yeah. Now, a record that I've been like really almost obsessing over, because it's one of those old-fashioned records where you get out the lyric sheet and follow along, is the new Aucherville River album. And it's on your list of stuff for the fall as well.
Well, I am very far. The last Aucherville River album I thought was terrific, but it was a series of nightmares. The album was written in such a way that it takes you inside the frontman and lead singer, Will Sheff, his mind, and gives you his dark fantasies. So unlike prior Aucherville River releases, there's really not a lot of specificity on the record. He doesn't ground you in a particular place or a particular time. You're really in his mind. Mm-hmm. So I think Will Sheff, being the kind of songwriter that he is, he almost overcorrects on this record. And now these albums are very specifically grounded. These are stories that are set in his hometown of Meriden, New Hampshire, in the year 1988. And they really are. I mean, he gives you lots of specific references. He talks about Atari on the record. He talks about things that you might think about in 1988. But what's so great about this album is that there's a real sense of 1988-ness on the record, but there's nothing gimmicky about it at all. He just kind of alludes to it in the way, because his range of allusion is so wide and his breadth of knowledge about popular music is so wide, that he doesn't have to hit you over with something that necessarily sounds just like Paula Abdul. He can kind of allude to the synth sounds of the time, or give you something that kind of sounds like a Tom Petty track from that time, and kind of weave it into the folk rock that he normally does. It's a pretty fascinating record, yeah.
In this song called Down, Down the Deep River, there's some of that 80s synth sound as well, and some great singing from his longtime colleague and friend Jonathan Myberg from the band Shearwater, right? Yeah. The album is called The Silver Gymnasium, the new one from the band Aucherville River.
Tell me I'm always going to be your best friend. Now you said it one time. Why don't you say it again? All the way down the line to where the telephone ends. Come on, shout it on.
Down, Down the Deep River, from the new record by Aucherville River. It's called The Silver Gymnasium, Will Sheff and Company. That might be the best song I've heard all year. I love that record a lot.
He's such a great singer, and he's got one of those voices that is unusual and that isn't necessarily what you might call a beautiful voice, but communicates so much character, and that's why he's such a good storyteller.
And you know, it's a catchy tune, but it's a very dark story. There's something going on. We'll have to ask Will about that. Will Sheff and the band are coming in to perform on Soundcheck next week. You can tune in to soundcheck.org Monday at 2 p.m. to hear the live session, or join us Tuesday evening at 9 p.m. to hear the final results. But Aucherville River joining us next week. Tris McCall of the New Jersey Star-Ledger with us today, looking ahead to some of the major, the important new releases coming out this fall. Who is Ty Tribbett?
Ty Tribbett, actually, album is out right now. It's called Greater Than, and it's an album that I'm completely obsessed with. It's a modern gospel record, which means that it's gospel that uses hip-hop and language of hip-hop and language of R&B and incorporates that stuff into a more traditional, what you might consider a more traditional gospel sound. He has been making records for a long time. He's a Camden guy, and so he's a Jersey guy. And I guess sometimes he gets compared to the Black Eyed Peas, but there are things about him that far transcend the musicianship of that you'd associate with Black Eyed Peas record. He's a great singer and a great choir leader, and a very, very interesting hooky songwriter too.
Let's go!
He is a heart fixer.
Heart fixer, heart fixer. He is a heart fixer.
Mind is my healer.
Healer, healer.
Yeah.
He is my healer.
Provider, provider. He's my provider.
Song's called Nobody from Ty Tribbett, a gospel singer from Camden, New Jersey. So local boy for you, Tris.
Yes.
Tris McCall, music critic for the New Jersey Star-Ledger, looking ahead to some potentially important records this fall. Greater Than is the name of Ty Tribbett's record. What's going on there? I mean, sounds like a big band and a very versatile one.
It's a very big band and a very big choir. And he gets into, in that song alone, he gets into several different movements. There's a part that kind of sounds like 80s Michael Jackson. There's a part that sounds like contemporary hip hop. He's drawing as much in as possible to bring you into church music. Mm-hmm. And it's part of the strategy. And
all right,
it worked
now,
for me.
From the sacred to the profane, we can talk about Danny Brown, the Detroit rapper. We cannot play even a fragment of this guy's music on the radio.
It's part of his appeal, yes.
So he's got a new record out, and also The Weeknd, who is Abel Tesfaye from Toronto. Mm-hmm. What do these two guys have in common?
More than you'd necessarily think, considering that Danny Brown's a very raunchy rapper, and The Weeknd is an R&B singer, kind of a beautiful R&B singer. They both came to prominence by releasing music for free on the internet, and this was a couple years ago. The Weeknd put out 3 albums on the internet that were downloadable for free and made a huge name for himself by doing it because the albums were this dark, wander through clubland, hallucinatory, R&B as sort of a glimpse of the underside of club life. And they've been repackaged as a trilogy and got him a major label deal. Danny Brown was similar. He was a regional rapper, Detroit rapper. He put out an album called Triple X for free on the internet. And it is a fascinating record because it really does function as a full album, even though the tracks were given away for free. You kind of start with a portrait of the rapper's psyche. And then slowly, as the album goes on, the camera pans back. Mm. And he starts telling you about his crew, the street, the people that he goes out drinking with. Then suddenly you see his block and you begin to see the devastation of Detroit. Then he pulls the camera back even further and you see Detroit's layout, and he starts to talk about how it's house, field, house in Detroit.
So it's one long tracking shot.
Yes,
basically.
One big tracking shot. Yeah. And then by the end of the album, you're almost up in the cosmos, and you're seeing, and you're dealing with Danny Brown's almost cosmic existential concerns.
But his new record, it's coming out later this month.
On Fool's Gold Records. So both Danny Brown and The Weeknd are putting out their albums through labels this time. So now this time you got to pay for it.
All right. Well, you got to wait a little while for Danny Brown's record coming out on September 30th. The Weeknd's record is next Tuesday, September 10th. It'll be called Kissland, and this is a song from it called Professional.
What does it mean? Oh, when your heart's already numb, your professional won't treat it like it's personal. No. It's just love. It always makes its way back around. It's dispensable. To fall is unacceptable. 'Cause everything you've been through made you stronger. And every day you learn about yourself. And nothing really played out how it's supposed to. Depending on somebody else as well. And now you know the value of a dollar. And girl, I make enough of it to spend. I love the way you put yourself together. I love the way you make that body bend for me again.
The Canadian R&B artist who records under the name The Weeknd, without the third E. So it's Week and then ND. Professional is the name of the song from the forthcoming record called Kissland. Tris McCall, music critic of the New Jersey Star-Ledger, looking ahead to some records that are either just out or coming out this fall. Some big names have records due. We heard about Arcade Fire, you know, announcing October 29th is the name,
no name
as the date. We don't know the name yet. Eminem has a new record coming out, Marshall Mathers LP number 2, due on November 5th. Justin Timberlake with the 2020 Experience Volume 2, for all those who went for Volume 1. But then there's a name that is not nearly as well known, at least not yet. Tell us about Lorde, L-O-R-D-E.
She's 16 years old, so she's a teenager from New Zealand, who has fired a shot that's been heard around the world, a song called Royals, that is now knocking on the door of the top 10. So it's a song that kind of came out of nowhere to become a hit. And it's her voice is similar in some ways to Adele's. Mm-hmm. And the production kind of has that spacious modern R&B sound to it. But I think what's interesting about the song is that thematically, it's extremely similar to Thrift Shop, big hit song that is much maligned in many quarters for taking pot shots at hip-hop, the materialism in hip-hop. Lorde basically does the same thing. What Royals is about is she is singing from the perspective of somebody who doesn't have a lot of money, and she's singing rather resentfully about the way that materialism is shoved down her throat. It's in a way and many of the signifiers that she uses in the song are hip-hop signifiers. So in a way, it's a shot at this whole culture. So it's a shot from New Zealand. Hmm. So it's kind of cheeky. You think, it's a 16-year-old girl from New Zealand. We don't really know much about her history. She's firing her arrow at hip-hop. So it takes some cheek and it takes some audacity to do that. Yeah. So will she be able to back that up with a full album's worth of interesting songs? The other stuff that I've heard by Lorde does suggest that maybe we do have something here, somebody who has something to say, even if what she says rankles people, which is, I think, always a good sign in a young artist.
So we'll find out for sure on October 1st when the album comes out. It'll be called Pure Heroin. Mm-hmm. That's heroin with an E at the end. This is the song that Tris is talking about from the artist Lorde. It's called Royals.
I've never seen a diamond in the flesh. I cut my teeth on wedding rings in the movies, and I'm not proud of my address. In a torn up town, no postcode envy, but every song's like gold teeth, gray goose dripping in the bathroom, bloodstains, ball gowns, trash in the hotel room. We don't care, we're driving Cadillacs in our dreams. But everybody's like crystal, Maybach, diamonds on your timepiece, jet planes, islands, tigers on a gold leash. We don't care, we aren't caught up in your love affair, and we'll never be royals.
Royals.
It's a run in our blood, that kind of love's just ain't for us. We crave a different kind of buzz. Let me be your ruler.
Royals by the young New Zealander Lorde. Her debut EP called Pure Heroin is out on October 1st, but that song, as Tris McCall has been telling us, is already knocking on the charts. We'll see whether there's more where that came from. Tris, before I let you go, Drake has a record coming out later this month.
I'm probably more excited about this than any other album. I mean, Drake said at the end of his last album, his sophomore album, that my junior and senior will only get meaner. And I'm going to hold him to that. Mm. I think that I expect it to be meaner. Drake has kind of made his name with a sort of moody, confessional variant of hip-hop where he takes you inside his head. He gives you late-night confessions, late-night storytelling. And that's really distinguished him from his peers. But I think that he's going to come out rougher this time. I think he's going to come out more two-fisted. And from the first single, Started From the Bottom, I think he's going to tell his story as a story of triumph this time. And I think it's going to be exciting to hear that from him.
Tris McCall is music critic for the New Jersey Star-Ledger. Tris, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
This is the second single from the forthcoming Drake record. It's called Hold On, We're Going Home.
I got my eyes on you. You're everything that I see. I want your high love and emotion endlessly. I can't get over you.
can find a link to Triss McCall's fall preview of upcoming albums on our website, soundcheck.org. Up next, a look at the use of the drug MDMA, or Molly, in the world of electronic dance music. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The three-day Electric Zoo Festival, held annually on Randall's Island here in New York, is a major event within the EDM, or electronic dance music, community. But this past weekend, the third and final day of the festival was canceled following the deaths of two festival attendees. And although their causes of death haven't been officially confirmed, the New York City mayor's office stated that, quote, both appear to have involved the drug MDMA, subtitled Ecstasy or Molly, unquote. Joining me on Soundcheck today is Kia Macareci, who is entertainment editor for the Huffington Post and has written about the EDM scene and this development at the Electric Zoo Festival. Kia, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And Irina Alexander is also joining us. She wrote a piece for the New York Times about the drug MDMA earlier this year. Irina, good to have you here as well.
Thanks for having me.
Kia, let me start with you. This is the first major EDM, electronic dance music festival, to be completely shut down due to drug concerns. Is that right?
Right, that's the story. And there have been some festivals in the past that have had issues with Molly or drug-related incidences, and most notably the Electric Daisy Carnival, which used to be in Los Angeles but moved to Las Vegas. But the events at Electric Zoo do seem like the first time that a full day was canceled.
Now, you know, we've talked about Electric Daisy in the past for the same sort of grim reason. This festival is run by a company called Made Events, and they seem to have a reputation for doing things right.
Yes, even the mayor's office said that they didn't want to put a lot of blame on Made Event, the organizers and promoters of the festival, because they sort of have been seen as having a really intense attention to detail and haven't really had incidents of this scale in the past.
Right. So the third day of the festival canceled. They're offering refunds to concertgoers. Let's talk about this collision of EDM and MDMA, or Molly. I mean, the boom of electronic dance music here in the States is a relatively recent one. What would you say, 3 years, maybe five?
Right. I would say it's definitely 3 to 5 years. Electronic dance music was very popular and has been for about 20 years or so in the underground scene, but this is really the first time we're seeing it explode at such a pop level where you can have festivals that are attracting a few hundred thousand people. So that's definitely the biggest wave to date.
Right. And, you know, when the electronic dance scene started, you know, ecstasy was kind of a part of it, the drug ecstasy. Molly is what? A kind of resurrected, allegedly purer form of the drug?
Right. Molly is sort of a term that was, at least, I think it's, you know, the reputation is obviously being challenged in recent weeks and months, but it was seen as sort of a pure form of MDMA, which is, you know, the most active ingredient, I guess you could say, in ecstasy.
And it has become a part of the culture to the point that, you know, some of the DJs are actually referencing it in their songs. Listen to this from French producer and DJ Cedric Gervais. He put out this song called Molly last summer.
Hi, I am looking for Molly. I've been searching everywhere and I can't seem to find Molly. Do you know where I can find Molly? She makes my life happier, more exciting. She makes me want to dance. Please help me find Molly.
So that is Cedric Gervais and his song Molly. Molly makes me want to dance. Please help me find Molly. Irina, he's not fooling anybody here. He's not trying to fool anybody, right?
No, he isn't.
So what is the, I mean, what is the relationship between this drug, whether you call it MDMA or Molly or ecstasy, and electronic dance music? It's they've been so intertwined for so long.
Well, that's right. I mean, they basically go hand in hand. You know, the rise of Molly, this uptick in use of Molly MDMA, is in part due to the rise of EDM and sort of becoming more mainstream, more popular. You can even tell, you know, aside from the EDM artists, you have it infiltrating pop music acts such as, you know, Rihanna or Miley Cyrus or
Kanye.
Exactly. You have rappers
Rick
rapping
Ross
about
lost
it.
An endorsement because he, you
exactly.
know, sings about
I think,
spiking a drink with Molly.
Right, precisely. And I think Wyclef even has a song where he sings something like, I see Molly as the new cocaine. So there it is.
And when we talk about Molly, I mean, Kia was talking before about it as a kind of allegedly purer form of ecstasy, MDMA being the key ingredient here. What's actually happening?
That's correct. So basically, Molly is considered to be, and that's a key word, considered to be the pure form of MDMA, which is the main ingredient in ecstasy. And typically in an ecstasy pill, it is combined with other substances. And this could be speed, it could be caffeine, it could be methamphetamine, ketamine, even aspirin or baby powder. It could really be anything. And it's pressed into a pill, whereas Molly, it comes in a powder or brown crystals, which implies greater purity and therefore safety. It's, in fact, I think by now it's so popular that it's as contaminated as ecstasy once was. You know, just because it comes in a powder form does not imply greater purity or safety. In fact, I think some of the powders sold on the street as Molly have no MDMA in them whatsoever.
Kia, as EDM has crossed over and become more a part of the musical mainstream, has this drug crossed over as well?
I mean, I think so. I think, as you noted, a lot of the sort of champions, aside from that song that you played, of the drug as sort of something sceney and cool to do are really pop acts at this point, most recently Miley Cyrus. Madonna basically just called out the drug, although she claimed that she was referencing the song you played. At this point, it does sort of seem like it's entered the popular consciousness as a way to have fun, as sort of the party additive of the moment. And I do think that it is worth mentioning that there are some artists, like dead mouse really took Madonna to task last year when she made her comments, and most recently with the events at Electric Zoo, artists like Cascade have really been arguing that people sort of put these things behind.
So you mentioned Miley Cyrus, her song We Can't Stop. She has this line, "We like to party, dancing with Molly, doing whatever we want." Listen to this.
If you know- Cause we gonna go all night till we see the sunlight. Alright. So la-da-dee-da-dee. We like to party. Dancing with Molly. Doing whatever we want. This is our house. This is our roof. And we can't stop. And we won't stop. Can't you see it's we who own the night? Can't you see it's we who found that light? We can't.
That is Miley Cyrus, the song We Can't Stop, yet another song name-checking Molly, the designer drug known as MDMA, formerly known as ecstasy, and stated by the New York City mayor's office to have been involved in the deaths of two people attending the Electric Zoo Festival on Randall's Island here in New York this past weekend, the third day canceled. We're talking about this confluence of the drug MDMA and EDM, electronic dance music, with Kia Makareci, the entertainment editor at the Huffington Post, and Irina Alexander, who has written about the drug for the New York Times earlier this year. And Irina, that's two songs that we've heard that both refer to Molly and dancing. What are the physical effects of Molly, of MDMA?
Well, MDMA, I think part of the reason it got that name ecstasy in the 90s is, you know, those good feelings that it gives you. You know, you want to dance for hours, the euphoria, a feeling of closeness with your friends, diminished anxiety. So all of that kind of goes hand in hand with the raves that we used to know it for back in the 90s.
That all sounds fine.
It does, in theory.
So it was thought that the downside was not caused by the drug, but by the additives that were put into the pill.
That's right. Well, there were a few misconceptions in the 90s. You know, public officials had warned that ecstasy could lead to, I believe, Parkinson's disease and holes in your brain. And those theories have since been disproven, which is another reason that people suddenly think this drug is safe.
It's
but,
okay, yeah.
But very few people have actually died from MDMA itself. I think between the years of 1997 and 2000, there were three deaths, mm-hmm. two or three deaths based on MDMA on its own. So it's, you know, that wording that they use for the two people that died at Electric Zoo is related to MDMA use.
Right.
So, I mean, I would bet that whatever they took had other substances and not just MDMA.
Yeah. Now, who are the people who are, Irina, your article starts with people who were not attending raves or electronic dance music festivals. Who's the target demographic for this drug?
Well, I think it started out with, you know, ravers and then went to dance music fans. But really now, you know, it's sort of become a phenomenon. I mean, you have young professionals doing it, older professionals. You have people who tried ecstasy the first time around and are now saying this is ecstasy rebranded. It's sort of the purer form and so much safer. And, you know, that's contributing to that popularity.
Right. And Kia, in your article, as you mentioned, there are people who are making money on these festivals off the backs of the people who are attending them, and they have a certain responsibility. What could they realistically and constitutionally do? I mean, you can't, you know, without violating people's basic rights, you can't, like, you know, strip search everyone who's going into a festival.
Right. I do think that there are organizations like Dance Safe, which offer home testing kits. There are websites where people can even go so far as to compare if they're using a pill with a press on it to other reports. But it's worth noting time and time again that there really is no responsible way to use a substance that is not controlled and is highly illicit, because even when it comes to home testing or a pill report, there's no guarantee that any substance is evenly distributed throughout a batch of pills or certainly through powder. So I think it's important that people understand that the risks that they're taking. I don't think that DJs and musicians should necessarily be in a place to moralize, but it's also worth noting in a sense that, you know, this isn't the first scene or genre to be tied with drugs or with violent right. behavior or any negative connotation. And we've seen this with rock and roll. We've seen it with hip hop. So I do think that there's just the idea that information should be able to be spread by artists a little more easily is helpful.
Yeah. Irina, are we branding the EDM folks unfairly here? I mean, as Kia points out, drugs and rock and roll, they go back even older than rock and roll. I mean, you know, the bluesmen of the 20s and 30s.
That's absolutely right. I mean, Molly or MDMA are not popular only because of EDM. It just so happens that if you're going to party all night and dance, this is a drug you're likely going to be interested in, just like you might be interested in cocaine or something else. But it is by no means, you know, it is not popular because EDM music is popular.
Right. So I completely agree with that, and I give voice to that. But I do think that there's sort of a hesitation within the dance music scene to even take some level of responsibility. And I do think that while there are other genres that have similar issues, or people who are doing Molly, like you said, at nightclubs or at parties or at art events or wherever, I do think that these people are in a position, these artists and promoters, to distribute information and to sort of make sure that the scene doesn't necessarily get branded so firmly with the stamp of being wild or reckless that rock and roll was in the 70s or the late 70s.
Now, the deaths at the Electric Zoo Festival, that was never going to be a good time, but this is a particularly bad time for this to happen in the EDM industry, right, Kia?
Right. I think now is sort of the moment where the industry has exploded to a point where major business artists have been getting, or business interests have been getting involved. Most famously, Robert Silliman's SFX Entertainment has been spending hundreds of millions of dollars snapping up companies in the scene and was heading towards an IPO in the near future. So it's going to be a little bit risky to see how, you know, these types of associations affect investors and their confidence in the scene.
So this is becoming big business.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been big business on the other side of the Atlantic in the UK. After an event like this some years ago, they developed a law that actually lays some responsibility at the feet of promoters and presenters of EDM. Do we want to go down that road here in the States?
I think that's a you know, a risky road because there are elements of personal responsibility which are also important, but I think it would depend on the nature and the specifics. I do think that there should be some sort of standards for checkpoints when it comes to entering a festival, to on-site medical staff. I wrote in my piece that while a lot of festivals, which obviously don't want something like this to happen, it costs them tons of money, it's extremely disheartening and tragic, but there, I haven't really seen sort of the wandering medical presence that I would like to see in the middle of a crowd of 40, 50, 60,000 people, because there are medical tents, there might be ambulances on site, but when you're standing in the middle of a crowd that intense of people who are dancing and partying and the music is very loud and the lights are intense, it can be a very overwhelming and risky experience.
All right. Well, the 3-day Electric Zoo Festival, just the latest of the headline-grabbing events in the world of electronic dance music, and for all the wrong reasons, following the deaths of two festival attendees and the cancellation of the 3rd day of the festival. We've been speaking about it with Irina Alexander, who wrote for The New York Times earlier this year about the drug MDMA, and Kia Makarechi of the Huffington Post, who's written since the cancellation of the Electric Zoo Festival's 3rd day. And to both of you, Irina and Kia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This is Soundcheck. Okay, folks, well, this topic isn't going away, so we want to hear how you react to this conversation about MDMA, music festivals, and safety. Do you go to mega dance concerts like Electric Zoo? Do you think they need to be safer? How do you feel about the popularity of MDMA in the world of EDM? You can leave a comment on our website, soundcheck.org, or leave a message on our listener line, 866-939-1612. That's 866-939-1612. Tomorrow on the show, a cartoonist who's writing country music and two country legends who are collaborating. First up, you probably know the work of illustrator Sandra Boynton from her cartoons, books, and greeting cards, but you probably don't know her as a songwriter. Sandra Boynton talks about her collection of country songs called Frog Trouble, which features guests like Alison Krauss, Brad Paisley, and Ryan Adams. And two country music veterans and old friends, Emmylou Harris and Rodney Crowell, perform songs from their recent record, Old Yellow Moon. That's tomorrow on Soundcheck. That does it for the show today. See you back here tomorrow night at 9. I'm John Schaefer.